The following program is a PodcastOne.com production. Recorded live backstage, this is Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Now, here's your host, John Horn.
Today on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted, we're going to talk with Paul Dooley. He's a veteran actor who had a breakthrough moment with the director, Robert Altman. He also has a one-man show called Movie Dad, where he talks about playing the cinematic fathers to Julia Roberts, Molly Ringwald, and many others. Coming up, Paul Dooley on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. But before we talk with Paul, I want to take a second to talk about one of our sponsors who brings you this show for free. Alone is back for its fourth season, but this time around, the rules have changed. 10 hardcore survivalists will still be dropped into the unforgiving wilderness, but that is where the similarities with previous seasons end. These 10 participants are composed of 5 competing teams, brothers, fathers and sons, and a married couple who all have unbreakable bonds. The competitors will be split apart and dropped off as individuals equipped with their 10 items, 5 each. In order to win the game, they must mobilize, find each other, and survive on the island together longer than the other competing pairs. They will face extreme isolation and psychological distress, both individually and together, as they plunge into the unknown, self-documenting their experiences along the way. Can they work together, or will the strength of their bond crumble beneath the anvil of Mother Nature? At stake is $500,000 awarded to the team that can last the longest. The season also brings viewers back to North Vancouver Island, where the threat of predators is fiercer than last season, and the weather the harshest they've seen yet. So tune in to all new episodes of Alone, Thursdays at 10, 9 Central on History.
This is Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Welcome to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. We are joined now by actor and writer Paul Dooley. Paul, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, my friend.
So we are, what, one day away from the opening of your... Can we call it a one-man show? We have to call it a one-person show?
You can call it a one-man show.
A one-man show with
a ton of slides and pictures and film clips.
And you know the lead actor, is that right?
It's a Paul Dooley, which is me.
Okay.
And the cast party's not going to be any fun because there's nobody there.
Well, at least the actor can't complain about the writing or the writer can't complain about the acting. Is that right?
That's right.
Because they're one and the same. Tell us how Movie Dad came together.
Well, over the last especially 10 years, because I've had such a varied career in different kinds of areas of it, you know, television, film, stage, and who knows, radio, everything, people would say, you should write a book. But people say that very loosely. And I said, if I wrote a book and people laughed at it at home, I would never hear those laughs. So if I'm going to do anything, I'll just put it in a one-man show.
And when you're thinking about what it is you're going to put in that show, you have so many credits. How do you decide what are the good stories and what are the ones that you want to leave by the wayside?
Well, you have to leave a lot out. And, of course, what you don't want it to sound like is a resume or a laundry list or, and then I did this, and then I did this, and then it's boring. So in the actual show, I rarely mention my most well-known films. I figure they know it, and I talk about other things. When I was one of the first jobs at Three Penny Opera, with Charlotte Ray, B. Arthur, John Astin, and Kurt Weill's widow, Lottie Lenya.
Wow.
This is 1954, I think. And so I talk about things that don't usually know about me.
When I look through your credits, there is, I guess, a tipping point. And the tipping point seems to involve Robert Altman. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
And what happens with Robert Altman, and why is it important in your career?
Well, to that point, I was a New York actor, but not really a famous New York actor. And you really can hardly make a living on the stage because, you know, often you're in a play and it ends in 2 months or 1 month or 3 months. But the rates aren't really any very high, you know, like movie and television.
No, and they probably haven't gone up in 30 years, if that.
So I was acting and I did commercials and did a lot of different things and wrote commercials and directed things. But I wasn't known in film or television because most movies were made in L.A. And if they made a movie in New York, they cast it in L.A. And what you would get in New York is a day player, you know, who would come in for a 2 lines
right.
or something. So I hadn't really done much film, but I did a ton of commercials. And in a funny way, I picked up camera technique by just doing film.
Where to stand, where to look,
how to look. The whole lot of tricks of the trade. But anyway, I was doing an off-Broadway show, not even a play. but a collection of comic strips by Jules Pfeiffer, the famous cartoonist from the 40 years at the Village Vanguard, the Village Voice. I used to work at the Village Vanguard nightclub. But anyway, I'm doing that show, and they're all comic strips, so they're all about a minute long or a minute and a half, and so I'm playing 30 parts in one evening. So Robert Altman came to see it, and he immediately cast me as the father in the new movie called A Wedding. Carol Burnett was the wife, and he was happy to learn that I knew her from the get-go, and he knew that we had a relationship, and he thought that was a great idea.
And this was at Snooks Brenner?
Exactly. And funny thing is, when he did a thing called Thieves Like Us, down south, he rented a house next door to a guy named Snooks Brenner. And I've met his wife.
There was a real Snooks Brenner.
A real Snooks Brenner.
And then you did Popeye with him, is that right?
Yes.
And then a whole bunch of other movies.
I did a total of five.
Because what I notice in your resume is you look at kind of, let's call it AA, after Altman, and BA, before Altman. And you might remember these parts, you might not. The Out of Towners, Hotel Clerk, Up the Sandbox, Statue of Liberty Guard.
Yeah.
Death Wish, Cop at Hospital, Foreplay, Salesman. And then, and I think this is true of a lot of actors, your characters have names. Which is a turning point. I mean, I'm being glib about it, but it's like third spear carrier from the left, yeah, versus Julius Caesar.
Second man. Yeah. I did Out of Towners one day and the Slapshot one day. And they're fun to do, but it's not a career. No, anyway.
Slapshot, Hyannis Port announcer.
That's right. I said to a friend of mine at the time, I said, if I'm going to do something very wrong in this first movie with Altman, I'll probably be in more, because he loves a stock company. He likes to have the ensemble. He likes to have people on the set that he worked with before and whom he likes. It's much easier for him. So then he'd call me like every 6 months or a year, and I'd do another movie with him.
So at what point, and I think this is true for a lot of actors, do you realize that you don't have to have a side job? And I don't know if yours was, you know, tending bar, waiting tables, teaching, whatever it was. Do you remember when it was that you could actually make a living by acting? And what was the job that you left behind at that time?
Well, I spent 9 years in New York still having to have part-time jobs. Show business for 2 months, 3 months off. Show business for 2 days, 3 months off. So I had a lot of part-time jobs. It was 9 years, and I got a job in a commercial, and I auditioned for many, many, many commercials, never got them. Then I got one. They loved me. I became the spokesman, signed a contract, every residual, double scale, and I went from $3,000 a year in 1960 to $40,000 for this.
It's good money back then. Good money now.
A guarantee as a spokesman.
What was the company?
Fab Soap.
Fab Soap.
Is
that a laundry, like a dish detergent?
It was a big one in those days.
Yeah.
There used to be a lot of them. One was called Duz, D-U-Z.
Sure.
Fab.
I think my parents used that.
And when I finished that year with them, everybody in the advertising business was familiar with my face and my acting. Then I just continued doing 9 million commercials.
The other thing that allows you to do when you can make a living off commercials or whatever else it is, you can start saying no to parts and start saying yes to things that are important to you.
Yep.
When you're thinking about the early choices you made in your career, you have this great relationship with Robert Altman. At what point do you start getting to pick things that you think you are well suited for? And would you say that those roles had a general similarity or they shared some common attributes?
Well, oddly enough, although Bob kicked my career off and kept it going, the thing that made me go a couple steps up the ladder was Breaking Away. Peter Yates directed, Steve Tesich wrote, Tesich won the Oscar for the script. And it was
it's about the bike racers,
yeah,
right?
It was generally thought to be a sleeper hit. And I still get jobs from it, and people still remember from it. But I was a father who was both cranky and also funny and also touching at the end. And that was the kind of typecasting that happened. But rather than all the Altman movies, it was the Breaking Away thing that caused people to call me. And if I meet a new director and he's 30 years old, well, in film school, he saw that bike movie.
That's very important, though, that people who might be a younger or different generation know your work from what they've seen from movies that matter. It could be Breaking Away. It could be an Altman film.
Yeah.
But they're movies that have a pedigree, that have a quality, yeah, and you're associated with good filmmakers.
Yeah, and for example, 16 Candle became a perennial.
Mm-hmm.
And there's almost nobody that doesn't know, not only the population, but directors and people in our business.
When you were working with directors like John Hughes or Robert Altman, maybe there's some others that I can't...
Yeah.
Come to
Christopher Nolan.
Christopher Nolan. What do you take away from them as an actor? How do they influence what it is that you want to do and the improvement that you might make as a performer?
Oddly enough, because I'm asked this question so many times, to my amazement, film directors don't really tell you much about your acting. They may do it if you're the ingenue, if you're the lead, but I think you're chosen because you're right for the part. And Altman and many other directors have said, if you cast it properly, well, that's most of it.
That's 90% of the work, right?
Yeah, you get the right guy. You get Seymour Hoffman. You don't have to worry about whether he's right or wrong. He'll make it right. But they didn't tell me much. I worked with stage directors to some extent. When I met Robert Altman, I was surprised they didn't tell me how to do it. It's faster, slower, come in later. What? Nothing. He just trusted you, and if you did it, he liked what you did.
But that's got to be, if you're trained and you know what you're doing, that's got to be very liberating to have a filmmaker say, I trust you with this character. Do with it what you will. I'll tell you if you're on the wrong track, but
exactly.
I'm going to let you do what you do.
He said, remember, I can always cut out the parts I don't like. I heard actresses say to him, Bob, I don't know how to play this character. He said, forget it. It's not the character. I hired you. You were the character. I didn't want something written on paper. I liked what you do, so it'll be you or you're the character. They couldn't believe they would let him just be themselves.
I want to go back to West Virginia, where you were growing up, and how you figured out how to make a path from West Virginia to New York or wherever it is you traveled to pursue your dream.
Well, I first got an inkling that I might like to be an actor. When I saw Buster Keaton, I was 15 years old. It was an 8mm screen, a rented thing from Black Hawk in Chicago. I think you'd pay 50 cents to get it.
It was probably the mid-late 30s?
Early 40s.
Yeah. Early 40s, okay.
A guy I knew in high school, I was a poor kid. His parents had money. I'd go to his house, and he would show me, play jazz records, and he would show me silent films and even Laurel and Hardy and W.C. Fields, all this stuff. Well, it fascinated me, especially Buster Keaton, whom I seemed to relate to. So then my friend and I would go out and make silent movies, and I still have some, and I put portions of them in my one-man show. And it looks like the real thing, although we're not anywhere near as funny as the real professionals. But before that, I started listening at 12 to radio, and I got hooked on jokes. I didn't think I could be an actor.
Like Jack Benny? I mean, what were you listening to?
Everybody. Fred Allen, Jack right. Benny, Bob Hope, George Burns and Gracie sure. Allen, and there were tons of them. There was a program called Durante and Moore with Jimmy Durante and Gary Moore. They were a team. They called him the nose and the haircut. Gary had a crew cut. The thing is, Jimmy Durante was almost inarticulate almost illiterate. He didn't read well.
Right.
He couldn't read the scripts. He kept mispronouncing catastrophe, you know. It became his style to make, so the writers would write into it, these mistakes. And the other guy was more erudite, and they made a good team, And the crazy thing is that from that age on, if I heard it and I liked it, I memorized it. Memorized it. I once worked with Gary Moore 30 years later, and I said to him in a quiet moment when he was away from his group, I said a name, and he looked at me, and I did the monologue from my 12-year-old.
From a piece he had done?
Yes, on radio that I heard once.
30 years earlier.
Yes, because after the radio show, just in case I forgot, I would write it down. And he said, God, how do you remember that? I don't remember that. I said, well, I was impressionable. Anyway, so that's part of it. And as I say in my show, I really don't forget things I like, and I call myself an elephant for jokes. And in the show, we hear old one-liners from radio, you know, corny jokes from radio. The real people, then there's a piece of George and Gracie doing a really funny joke from radio. And eventually, I only went to the college because of the GI Bill. My parents didn't have any money. I thought I wouldn't. What's a college boy? I didn't even understand it. But my friend said, you can go to college. Not only you can study art, which I was working on drawings, but you can act. And I wasn't sold on college. He said, all the girls up there away from home for the first time, their parents aren't around. I said, okay, sign me up.
Yeah, that part.
Like the rest
Enough
of
for the studies. What about the girls?
Anyway, I learned in 4 years in college that this is what I wanted to do. I went to New York right afterwards.
Did you have money in your bank account? Did you have a job? Did you just have a car with full tank of gas?
I had $50, and a friend had actually, instead of selling it, had given me an old Dodge. It was like 10 years old. The first thing I found out in New York is you can't own a car because you can't pay for parking.
That's true.
So I got rid of it. But I went there with no money in my pocket, and I figured I'll get part-time jobs, and I'll find out.
Geffen Playhouse, Unscripted.
In order to feel comfortable that you're getting a fair price, you need pricing context. information that empowers you to feel confident. With TrueCar, you'll see what other people in your local market paid for the car that you want. And from there, you can connect with a local TrueCar certified dealer and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Using TrueCar, you can easily find the car you want, and TrueCar will show you what other people in your area paid for the car you want. Now you know what a fair price is, and you can feel confident. Once you register, you'll see real pricing on actual inventory. This is competitive pricing offered to you only by a TrueCar certified dealer for an actual vehicle on their lot. It's pricing that you'll see before going to a dealership, so you can feel confident when you show up. And with TrueCar, you can connect with a local certified dealer of your choosing, so you can enjoy a quick, easy buying experience. TrueCar customers are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with their TrueCar certified dealers, and TrueCar users save an average of more than $3,000 off MSRP. When you're ready to buy, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.
Hey, have you heard? Podcast One has a whole bunch of awesome new shows filled with big names that are waiting for you on our brand new amazing app.
This one's a game changer.
There's Norman Lear talking to Amy Poehler, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and Charles Barkley. Geffen Playhouse Unscripted with Bryan Cranston, Josh Gad, and soon Neil Patrick Harris.
Nice.
OC Real Housewife Heather Dubrow's World. Lady Gang's Three Mimosa Podcast with Leah Michelle, Nelly Furtado, Elle King, and more.
Plus every episode of The Adam Carolla Show, Dan Patrick, and Rich Eisen.
And if you like what happens in the ring, we've got Steve Austin, Chris Jericho, Chael Sonnen, and a whole bunch more.
So download our one-of-a-kind new app and see for yourself.
Go to the App Store, Google Play, or download it now at podcastone.com.
Now back to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
What was your first gig that wasn't a part-time job? Do you remember? Were you doing stand-up? Were you doing...
Well, after doing some knockabout bread-and-butter jobs, I got into three-penny opera. I only did it for the first year, and it really ran for 7 years. Then I went up into the mountains to work in sketch work with Carol Burnett and people like that.
That would be the Catskills, the Adirondacks?
Not the Catskills. There's a more upscale mountains, which is in the Adirondacks.
Sure.
And they were places where Danny Kaye cut his teeth and people like that. It was called Green Mansions. And we had a staff lyricist who was there all summer writing lyrics. It was Sheldon Harnick, who wrote Fiddler.
That's amazing.
Just
a
got
staff
out of
lyricist.
Northwestern. So we had really classy reviews, and every Labor Day we would do the best of our shows, and all the critics, not critics, all of the agents came up from the city to watch them. And many people were picked out from those things to be on the stage or get work. Then I went through a stage where I did stand up. I did The Tonight Show before Johnny Carson had ever heard of it. Jack Parr.
Jack Parr was the host, right?
Yep. And I just looked at something in my scrapbook the other day, and I'd forgotten this because I'm backstage and not paying attention. I was on my show the first time on Tonight Show, and one of the guests is Sammy Davis Jr. I hadn't even remembered that.
Wow. And he's probably a young comedian or yeah, young singer, was he?
Well, you know, he started really working with his father, mm-hmm. the Will Masson Trio, was his uncle and his father. And he started tap dancing at 6 or 7 or 8. So he was already a young star when he was, you know, 20, I suppose.
We're talking with Paul Dooley. His new show is called Movie Dad. It's at Theater West. When you're working on a play like Movie Dad and you're trying to figure out what it is you're going to share, that involves a lot of looking back at your life and your career. What kind of memories does that kind of scrapbooking do to you when you're looking at all these, and I hope you keep a lot of stuff, when you're looking at all the things you've done, what had you forgotten, even if you have a great mind, that was a really warm and kind memory?
Well, I am a kind of a pack rat, so in my garage or my attic or wherever it is, I have reviews and programs and all kinds of things. Got a note from Doc Simon when I did The Odd Couple. He says, good luck.
For people who don't know, that's Neil Simon.
Yeah.
There was a racehorse named Doc Simon, made me some money on that, but Doc Simon was Neil Simon.
Yeah, his brother's Danny Simon. But they used to call him Doc, I hear, because he thought he might want to be a doctor first. Turns out he became a play doctor,
yeah.
A script doctor. Well, where was I?
Simon. Doc Simon sends you a note.
Yeah. And it says, good luck. I couldn't think of anything funny.
That's not a great
And
note.
He says, and Mike Nichols sent me a telegram that night and said, if you can't be good tonight and funny, be clean. I didn't think he meant in terms of jokes. I thought he meant take a bath.
Like brush your teeth and floss.
He wanted to do a non-joke.
Your show is called Movie Dad, and it is because you have played some movie dads to Molly Ringwald, Julia Roberts. I'm probably forgetting Hilary Swank. Is that right?
Yeah. No,
who else am I forgetting?
Mia Farrow, and there's about 30 of them.
At what point does that become, I won't say annoying, it's like we've got a part for you, you're going to play the dad to this actress, or is that what you love playing?
I love working.
Okay.
So if it happens to be a dad, it's fine. And I know that every job can get you another job. So some of that is. But, you know, when I started working with Larry David doing Curb and Christopher Guest, where we improvised our own lines, then I got away from fathers, although I was Larry David's father-in-law. But, you know, you're making up your own dialogue and you don't have to be a cutesy father or a sweet father.
But what you're describing, too, is the idea that you are working at a time when there are shows like Curb, when Christopher Guest is making his movies, where the whole idea of what is kind of written and improvised, what is not network television, what is on cable, what is on streaming services, is evolving. And as somebody who has worked as a comedian and done comedy, that's got to be a great intersection of history and modern day, that the skills that you picked up
Absolutely.
Very early in your career, many years later, are incredibly valuable.
Absolutely. And it used to let me, because I was pretty good at humorous commercials, they often let me make up things in the commercials. As long as they kept the copy points, I could make up an ending and do a button, as we used to call it. And they would often let me do this. And the more I did it, and the more people who knew me in New York, the more freedom I was given to augment the commercials I did.
And how important is improv training to you, and how has that served you well in terms of any kind of acting, including theater acting?
I think it was a tremendous, oddly enough, because I was poor for those early years in New York, and there weren't really great acting teachers in West Virginia.
There might not still be any, but yeah, who knows?
You know, they all have West Virginia accents trying to teach me how to speak, do Shakespeare. But the point is, what was I saying?
Improv.
Improv, yeah. I used to think of myself as, when I got into Second City, maybe on a scale of 10, I was about a 5 as an actor, my evaluation of myself. By the time I left it after a couple of years, I thought I was 9 or something. Because you learn so much when you're creating your own stuff, because you're getting responses and you're able to change and you're being a character instantaneously and you're working with other people who inform you and your characters inform me what they say to you and what they do, because it's give and take, as you know, in improv. The only rule that people think is very hard, listen and agree. That's the rule.
Yes and, right?
Yes and, you bet your life. I also did this. I finally got out of the on-camera commercial business and started doing radio commercials and adding to them with our funny and my two of my partners from Second City. Then we said, to hell with this. Instead of us improving their scripts for no money, let's get creative fees. And we began to be producers who provided scripts with the input they gave us, but then all the characters and the humor and the funny was presided. And we did, in about 12 years, probably 1,000 radio commercials.
Wow.
That way. Two Second City partners of mine.
And was that your voice as we are hearing it now, or would you be any iteration of character?
Oh, no, I would do different things. We had an account for Utica Mutual Insurance. They told us they wanted a home loan, a boat loan, a motorcycle loan. They wanted a marine loan. They had all these different things. So I wrote a commercial, wrote the premise of it anyway. And my partner interviewed me, and I was Noah. And I
needing some flood insurance?
Yeah, and needing flood insurance and marine insurance, they called it. So he says to me, just a couple of things. Give me your name and the name of your boat. And I said, Noah Zark. And he said, all right, Mr. Zark. And what is your name? And near the end, he said, well, should I make the policy out for 1 year or two? And I said, make it 40 days and 40 nights. But we had a lot of fun with this. And it was like going to work and being with your friends. And unlike film and television, there's no makeup, no wardrobe, no Winnebago, no waiting. You just come in, do your job, and leave. It's just wonderful. I still love radio. Well, you do too, in a way.
I love radio and podcasting. They're one and the same almost.
Absolutely.
Would you say there is a part that you would, if you put together a little time capsule of the parts that meant the most to you, and it could be something that's very small that a lot of people wouldn't recognize, that for you was incredibly rewarding or came at a great or pivotal time in your career, What would some of those parts be, even if they're not the most well-known that you've played?
Well, first off, no question, Breaking Away. It was a great script, a great director, and a terrific, they cast it beautifully. The part seemed like my father. I played him like my father, and it worked out fine. I've since been playing my father in almost all my dad roles. A little cranky, a little bit, unemotional, but in the end, you can count on him, and maybe there's a heart of gold. But then I did, I worked with Bobcat Goldthwait once in his comedy called Shakes the Clown, which is special to me. I did The Strange Brew with the McKenzie brothers, Doug and Bob McKenzie.
From Great White North?
Yeah. And one of my co-stars is Max Uncito, and that was fun. Once I said to him, sit down, you're rocking a boat. From the old song.
I know the show.
You may not know that from my resume, but I also took a side trip and created the Electric Company to teach kids to read at PBS for Sesame Street people.
Now, am I remembering, was that Morgan Freeman on that show too?
He was, yeah.
Okay. I was around, sadly. I'm that old to watch the Electric Company with Morgan Freeman.
Well, the cast that we already had to begin with was Rita Moreno, who was doing it for scale for her people in the ghetto or in the inner city, which you try to appeal to kids in the inner city, and Cosby to his people. And they worked for nothing, scale, I mean.
Wow.
And it was done for 7 years. They wouldn't have to come in every day. They would bank sketches, put them away, and use them when they needed them. But I wrote 130 episodes with my help from some staff.
When you have done so many things over the years, I hope it's not an embarrassing question. Smallest residual check you've ever received?
4 cents.
I mean, the stamp, even if it was sent recently, cost three times that. Do you cash it or do you frame it and put it on the wall?
There's a place in the Valley called Residuals. And if you bring in something under a dime, they'll put it up on the wall.
You get a free drink at least?
I think so. It's on Ventura.
That sounds like a good trade.
Yeah.
When you are doing a show like Movie Dad, you are on stage and you're performing for a live audience, and they are going to react to the show as any audience would. They're going to either like the stories or they're not going to like the stories. But it's different because the stories are your stories. Does it add a different dimension, not of pressure, but of what you are giving the audience in terms of yourself, that you're not playing a character, you're not Lear kind of on the mountaintop, you are sharing your stories? And how does that change the relationship between yourself and the people in the seats?
It's hard not to begin to identify with the actors you're working with. Yes, of course, we have pages and we learn our words, but you're going to make the scene better if you start connecting in some way. Well, the time I started doing movies, I had at least two kids, and the experience of being a father and understanding kids became very helpful in the way I dealt with actors and actresses who did that. And in general, it's always helped me to draw on life's experience to do any part. I also love to do crazy roles, doing things I would never do, like with Larry David and Chris Guest. So I really like it all. I like broad comedy. I like subtle comedy. I adore Mike Nichols and Elaine May, and I love Bob Newhart. But I also love very broad comics like Bert Lahr, people like that. I'm just the whole diaspora, I guess you could call it.
And what does theater give you that radio, film, television doesn't? Why do you like to be on stage to this day?
Very simple, laughs and the connection with the people. And in my show, I have some moments where I'm telling some sad things about my career, which I don't usually tell in publicity because I don't want them to be surprised. But if I hear people gasp a little, or you might hear somebody sobbing a little, that's the kind of reward you get if you're doing jokes and getting laughs. It's the connection that you're really reaching people, and you know that your story is being felt.
A lot of people would recognize you in the grocery store, the car wash, wherever you're going. Do they often conflate you with the characters you play, and what is that conversation like?
Well, the two are 16 Candles and Breaking Away, especially. Although, oddly, somebody comes along and says Slapshot, even though it's,
that's very good.
It's a tiny part. Often a truck driver will lean out of his window and say, "Refund, refund, refund." And they if they're over 40, they remember me from Breaking Away. If they're under 40, they remember me from 16 Candles. And tons of women have come up to me and says, "I wish you'd been my father. You were such a great father to Molly." And now I finally have to tell them, I don't have to be that great a father. It's written down. So
it's a lot in real life, you don't want to see me.
I learned the words, and I said them the best I could, and I'm glad that they were touching. But I said, in real life, not all fathers are tremendously understanding at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Let me ask you this last question. When you're playing a movie dad and the actresses who are playing your daughter are talking to you about your relationship, what are those conversations like? What do they want to know? What do you want to know from them?
Well, the most intimate seemed to be with Molly Ringwald. There's a big scene where it's the middle of the night and we had forgotten her birthday all day. And she's upset also because the boy she likes doesn't like her. And I come down to say in the middle of the night, we're sorry we forgot your birthday. I apologize. Then we have a long talk about the guy, you know, who it is. And she's explaining he's this big something. He's perfect. And I'm just a little nobody. And I said, listen, you know, if he doesn't realize how wonderful and sweet you are, then it's his problem. And so it really is a very touching scene that every young girl I meet, if they know it, and I think every year a new bunch of 16-year-olds discover it, they all identify for somewhere because they want that kind of scene to happen in their real life.
Well, and I think that's why filmmakers like John Hughes matter, because they say things about being a parent and about being a child that aren't always said but need to be heard.
Yeah, what I noticed about John, because people ask me about John Hughes, is that when we were first doing 16 Candle, some of the adults were like older, like Getty Watanabe, who's the Asian guy who was very funny in it. But the stars of it, the kids were 16 or 17. And at the end of a day, a director usually goes to dinner with the cameraman and the producer, and that's it, two or three people. He went out with the kids and had dinner.
That's great.
And if they went to a concert on Saturday, he went with them. And I thought of John as a big kid, which I think is how come he could write so well for them. He knew their language, how they talked, how they felt. And I think that helped all of his movies.
Paul Dooley is an actor and a writer. He has written and will perform in Movie Dad. It's at the Theater West on Cahuenga in L.A. through July 23rd. Do I have that right, Paul?
Yep.
Paul Dooley, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
That was the actor and the writer, Paul Dooley. If you like what you heard, you can check out past episodes. And while you're enjoying more from Geffen Playhouse Unscripted, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or at podcastone.com. And don't forget, rate, review, and share.
Thanks for listening to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Download new episodes every Wednesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or subscribe at iTunes.